Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So it's the final day of our daily tennis podcasts from the WTA Finals. We're also going to, of course, cover the Paris Final. My word, what a week we've had. And we sit here in a proper spit and sawdust pub. What's it called, Catherine?
Bricklayer's Arms. This is my local.
The Bricklayer's Arms.
It's a pub that runs out of beer whenever Fulham play at home.
Fantastic.
Which is... if anyone from the Bricklayer's Arms is listening, slightly disappointing.
When I walked in, two people over there were playing Monopoly, which is not something I expected when I walked into the pub.
It's a pub with dog biscuits on the bar,
right,
which is really all I look for.
I wonder why you seem so happy.
We've already had a chat with a greyhound, haven't we, Catherine?
Have you?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Deep dive on the... backstory of the greyhound.
Okay, right. So anyway, we've got our beers, we're ready to go, we've had finals, we've had doubles finals, and we've got loads to talk about. We haven't had Matt for 24 hours, so we've got lots to cover with Matt.
I feel like I've returned to the scene of a trauma after yesterday's Fulham, and it's only 24 hours later, and it's a bit too soon to be back in Putney, back in Fulham.
Yeah, to clarify, we can practically see Craven Cottage from this pub. It's on the other side of the river, but it is. You can hear the cheers when there are cheers.
They weren't yesterday.
From where we are, yeah.
And that was a 0-3 scoreline, correct?
It was awful. It was absolutely awful.
Right, okay. I think we better not dwell on that, folks. Right, so let's start with the WTA Finals final, which has crowned Ash Barty not only as the world number one and a Grand Slam champion this year, but she is the champion in Shenzhen in its inaugural year in that city. And she has taken home the biggest prize money check that tennis has ever known. $4.45 million, I think it was, which is more than double what Tiger Woods won for winning the US Masters this year. It is $1.5 million more than either Simona Halep or Novak Djokovic took away from winning Wimbledon this year. And, I mean, it is a mind-boggling sum of money. I mean, I personally think it's a pretty grotesque sum of money. But symbolically, it's of huge importance, isn't it? When you consider that she was handed that money with the Billie Jean King trophy... And in 1973, Billie Jean King set up the WTA with her colleagues in order to promote equality, which took a long, long time coming at the Grand Slams in terms of equal prize money. And here we are now in 2019 with this situation of women earning more money than men in tennis for a couple of years anyway. It is just a big moment, isn't it?
The money is the message, as Billie Jean King always says.
Yeah,
money talks.
It does.
And it silences all the market forces.
Yeah, it does.
Boo-hickey.
And incidentally, if ever there was a performance that you felt should be getting a check like that, it was what Ash Barty put out there today, because she took on the defending champion Elena Svitolina, who'd won 10 matches in a row. And I think that the best description of what Barty did today in a match that was on paper not that competitive. I mean, it was very, very competitive in the first set to about 5-4. But for the most part of it, certainly the second set, it was a bit like watching one of those Federer matches when it ain't competitive, but you don't care. Mm. Because it's so good, It's so flamboyant. It's so full of shot making that feels like you are watching the best singer or the best theatre performance. That's how it felt watching Bash Barty today.
Who's the best singer and the best theatre performance? Who are you specifically comparing her to here?
Okay, well, that's down to personal taste.
No, it's definitely Bruce Springsteen.
There we go.
Right, okay, so Matt has spoken. It's Bruce Springsteen, everybody. But
That's probably worth, that comparison is probably worth more to her than the 4.3 million.
She was just amazing. And it carries on from what we were saying yesterday when she turned it around against Pliskova, having to just withstand that broadside of power. Today, she went to, for the first nine games, they both just did what they do. Svitolina was a wall who was showing the most incredible movement, and you know it was going to take a special performance to beat her, and Barty was pulling out the box of tricks.
And there's essentially no way through Alina Svitolina's wall on that court. Like, no one had been able to do it this tournament and in Singapore last year in similar conditions. So Barty, instead of going through it, she thought, I'll go around it. And she comes up with...
What a great line.
She comes
and
up,
over it.
And over it and under it. She finds different ways to get through it that no one else is able to come up with because she's got such a complete game. She's got more shots than other players and she's able to deploy them with such kind of ease. It just seems to flow from her racket when she's in the kind of mood she was in today. And I think we do talk a lot about her slice and her variety, but equally her forehand is very much one of the best in tennis at the moment, the way she dominates with it. And she's now won titles on every single surface this year, on grass, hard clay, and now indoor. She's got such an adaptable game to all conditions, and a slow court which people can't find a winning formula, she does.
And this against a player who'd beaten her 5 out of 5. We've got a 5-love record against her. The most recent match they'd played was in Indian Wells this year. Barty had led 3-1 in that match and still been beaten in 3 hours and 12 minutes in Indian Wells. I mean, that is an epic loss, you know, I'm a bit surprised that there wasn't more sort of collateral damage, really, mentally, for Barty to have to overcome than that.
But I wonder if she saw it exactly as you saw it yesterday. She hasn't actually lost. She hadn't lost to Svitolina since she became the person and the player that she did now. It made me think that maybe in her mind, everything changed after Miami.
I think you're right.
I think she carried that head-to-head into that match for exactly that reason.
She's simultaneously, you could argue, the best player in the world and the most improved player in the world. She's an incredibly talented player, but she's just become a champion this year.
Well, that's it. I almost think she's made a double jump this year because a lot of the things she's achieved this year, first and foremost, were things such as top 10 debut, first Grand Slam quarterfinal, debut appearance at the WTA Finals. For most people, that would be a good year, like a step forward. But she's made all of them sort of secondary accomplishments because she's turned top 10 debut into world number one. She's turned Grand Slam quarterfinal into winning the French Open. And she's turned being at the WTA Finals into winning it. She's made such a huge leap in 12 months. And I think it's important to keep that perspective that this time 12 months ago, Barty was not this player at all. She has made such an improvement.
Yeah, and the second set, I just was open-mouthed at times at the way she decided to try to beat Svitolina. She was tying her up in knots. There were a couple of rallies where she was getting pushed side to side, so instead of carrying on that formula, she'd drop on short, and this is clearly a tactic she'd worked out, because backhand to backhand, Svitolina, over the 5-match series between the two, Andrew Bethells, her coach, had said, so that's the weakness for Barty. If you keep going backhand to backhand, you will win the match if you go hard. And so she didn't give her those rallies at all. She would slice short and force Svitolina to come forwards. And when she did, she would lob sometimes, and then when it came back, she would hit another one low at her ankles, and then she would sort of push a passing shot. I reckon she must have sort of paddled about 5 passing shots past Svitolina today without any pace on them really at all. No topspin, none of that.
And sometimes they themselves were the winner, and sometimes they set up her next shot. She's always thinking several shots ahead. You described we kind of recorded a podcast before even hitting record, didn't we? And you were saying, David, she's a bit like a snooker player in that. She's strategically thinking, if I hit that ball there, I'll get this one back, and then I'll be able to finish the point. And that really, I think she's kind of alone in that. I mean, maybe Andreescu has a similar quality, but Barty, I think, does it even better. You can see her working these points out.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I would say Andreescu is there's a flair to her game, and there's a flamboyance and a power maybe that Barty doesn't. She has some power on the forehand, but it's not quite like Andreescu, who's just a bigger frame, etc. Yeah, I don't think anybody picks out shots to hurt the opponent quite the way I saw Barty using today, without just a single pattern. There was a moment where she ran forwards to a drop shot, and she looked like she'd basically got five options. She could have rolled a topspin either way. She could have paddled one to the backhand with sort of forehand slice, or she could have hit drop shot. Instead, she just sort of closed the face of the racket and just poked it down the line. And Svitolina is just standing there completely wrong-footed and unable to move that way at all, because she's already started to go one of the other directions.
It's one of those where when you watch her from the privilege of the kind of TV angle, you almost think you should be able to tell what they're doing because you've got that height. But even when you're watching as a viewer, you can't tell what she's doing. So that's kind of, the effect is doubled and even more difficult for who she's playing, who is seeing it all in that kind of real time. Yeah, she bamboozles, she constructs her own points, and it's transferable. As I said, it works everywhere, which is such a skill to have in a sport which defines itself by kind of having that variation throughout the season and different surfaces, different seasons, different conditions. Barty can do it everywhere.
Catherine, Australian Open.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Sam Stosur win the US Open and come to the Australian Open and she just couldn't be herself there. We've seen Amalie Mauresmo the same. What about Barty?
Different story altogether. I'm not saying she's necessarily going to win the Australian Open, although she has to be favourite as things stand at the moment.
Really? You think? Would you make her favourite?
World number one, just won the most recent tournament, having beaten four of the world's top eight. Yeah.
I mean, I think Andreescu has to be alongside her.
Because she doesn't lose tennis matches.
Because she doesn't lose tennis matches, and she won the most recent hard court slam.
Yeah,
essentially the favourite.
I mean, those situations you described are unique to those players. Ash Barty is a completely different specimen. I'm not saying she doesn't feel it. She's not going to feel any kind of pressure, but I'm struggling to think of an instance where I've really felt like Barty has struggled with pressure or visibly seemed to be suffering from that element of things. I can't think of any. She's so, I know all the they're cliches about staying present and all of that, all the sportsperson type lines. She embodies all of those. She's not trying to sort of hypnotize herself into behaving and thinking those ways, staying present, staying in the moment, just compete, do your thing, you know, we're a team, it's not just me out there, all of that stuff. There's a lot of players that try and convince themselves to think that way because it's effective, but it's all very real for her. That is, I think, just who she is.
And that makes it by a proper player at Australian Open. I mean, she was beaten by Petra Kvitova, who nearly won the title.
She performed well in that quarterfinal. And that in itself is a breakthrough for her, having reached that stage. So I'm so excited about what a big deal Ash Barty is going to be in Melbourne and in the lead up. That's going to be an absolute joy, I think. And I can't see, even if she doesn't win it, I struggle to see a scenario where she really underperforms. I really can't see that.
Would you agree with me that the hype in Australia, in terms of the attention and the newspaper front page coverage of certainly of the Australian Open and of Australian tennis players, is bigger than anywhere else that we go. It's certainly bigger than the US Open. It's certainly bigger than Wimbledon.
Oh, that's a really interesting discussion, but I'm not sure it's bigger than France. It's different. It's a lot more tabloidy. It's very, very tabloidy in Australia. And that makes the Barty thing really interesting, because she just... There's nothing bad to write about her. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing for tabloids to get their teeth into.
For the most part, I think even with when you see players like Alex de Minaur, people like Tomic and Kyrgios, yeah, they get stuck into them. But the ones they like, they really do big them up. They get on the bandwagon. You know, it's all about the bandwagon.
I mean, I feel like this year I read a line kind of saying that de Minaur could potentially win the Australian Open. I mean, we were a million miles from that.
I think that highlights it well. I think maybe column inches wise, I think possibly, I mean, in terms of representation at the French Open, I think there are more French journalists at the French Open. You know, you've got L'Équipe, which is a dedicated sports newspaper, yeah, which doesn't exist anywhere else, and it really is a significant force. But in terms of hype, I give it to Australia. They're into the hype.
I always think it's kind of difficult to be an Australian tennis player, in so much as you start your season at home, which is a pressure in itself. And it's almost like, if I don't perform here, well, that's it for another 12 months. But I do think that the fact that Barty is able to perform everywhere in all sorts of conditions might end up helping her in Australia, because you kind of think, this isn't the be-all and end-all of my season. Whereas for someone like, you know, a de Minaur, a Kyrgios, you know, they've kind of had their best results a lot of the time in Australia. It feels like there's such a pressure on them to perform there and then. Whereas Barty, I think, in herself, maybe not from the outside, but in herself, might be able to take that pressure off, because she knows she's done it elsewhere.
I wonder if the Fed Cup, being in Australia, will help her in the next couple of weeks handle January.
Surely. How can it not?
It's almost like a rehearsal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a different pressure, because it's more about playing for your team rather than just playing for yourself. But Barty kind of thinks of herself
anyway,
as a team, doesn't she? You know, the fact that she literally uses "we" to talk about "we're going to lift this trophy." She's the only one lifting the trophy, yeah, but she thinks about
that
her
helps
team
her, doesn't
so
it?
Much.
It helps her to deal with the moment.
Yeah, and there's a lot of players, if I heard them saying that, I think, what a load of whack. But I don't with Ash Barty, because I really believe that's how she feels about it, she sees it.
The other thing is, in her interviews this week, I felt all week how happy in her own skin she looks. That she's not, there's no doubts, this is me. I mean, there were great shots of her playing Aussie rules football on the court with her support team, and, you know, doing all the sort of silly Andy Murray type games that you see pre-match on the court with a tennis ball, playing football with it and whatever. And yeah, I actually think she will handle it really well. Yeah, I don't know about the conditions, what sort of court we can expect. Can you remember how fast was the court this year?
I feel like this year was a bit slower than it had been the previous 2 years, where they'd made conscious efforts to quicken it up.
I mean, she can handle any court surface.
She can.
That's the other thing, isn't it?
She can.
If you think about it, she's won on everything.
Yeah.
Oh, can we go tomorrow?
She's from Queensland, isn't she? So she's not going to have any issues with heat.
No, I mean, she was saying in that video I saw that, you know, she used to get up and play her lessons at 8 o'clock in the morning to avoid the heat when she was growing up. So she's well used to it all.
And then she ended up playing for the Brisbane Heat.
She did.
In the Big Bash.
She did. Yeah. So she's won the singles. The doubles was won by Kiki Mladenovic for a second year in a row, and her partner Tamer Babos, who's now won 3 in a row, and it was one-sided.
Who did Babos win it with 2 years ago?
I can't remember.
Who did Babos play with? Obviously, obviously Mladenovic played with Caroline Garcia before Babos, and that went up in flames.
We will be Googling this, folks. Don't you worry. It's absolutely fine.
Ultimate podcast faux pas.
So she beat in the final. She beat in the final Shea Sway and Barbora Strizova. Champions again. I mean, Mladenovic had got her whole family with her all week long. Her mum and dad were there. It was so euphoric. I mean, look, I think if you win $1 million between you in doubles, you feel pretty euphoric. But
yeah, because you were talking with Joe Jury on commentary about the way that the doubles prize money has gone up so much as well. What was it, Joe Jury? Did she
$24,000 between them? That's what they got.
And so that has gone up significantly as well.
Decent uplift. So Babosh in 2017 was partnering
Lavachkova.
Lavachkova, yeah.
Who's, of course.
I'll be honest, that was not on the tip of my tongue.
Nor mine.
So she's a very good doubles player. So yeah, well done to them. It was only about a 58-minute final, which I think is about what the men's final in Paris was in the singles, Catherine. Is that right?
Yeah, 58 minutes of Denis Shapovalov humiliating me. Thanks, Dennis. Yeah,
Catherine gave it the big build-up last night. And
never getting drawn in again.
So what happened? For those of us like me who didn't get to see it, I saw a couple of games. What happened?
Shapovalov was really poor. It was a real regression of a performance. And I know there are certain explanations for that. It's a situation he's never been in before, first Masters final. Some have speculated that not playing yesterday, the walkover against Nadal, disrupted his rhythm, although I really question the validity of that argument. I mean, how can not having to beat Nadal and Djokovic back-to-back be a... be
exactly.
a detriment to your chances of winning a tournament, end of a long season, etc., etc. But and him being 20 years old, etc. But it's not his first rodeo. He's not Novak Djokovic. He's not fifth. It's not his 50th Masters 1000 final. But I think it's okay to be expecting more from Denis Shapovalov now.
Was he prevented?
He really failed to deliver today.
Was he prevented from delivering, given Djokovic is so good?
Yeah, to an extent, Djokovic was absolutely brilliant. And I'm not saying that had Denis Shapovalov delivered, he would have won today. Absolutely not. Probably not. Probably wouldn't have won, but he could have done a lot better. And he just... it was so naive. It was such a naive performance. And
so what was he actually doing?
Just hitting out, making bad decisions, not making any returns at all.
Well, that was the thing. That was the big talking point pre-match, wasn't it? How much under Yuzhny Shapovalov has improved his returns, the ability to chip the ball back into play.
And block it.
And we had seen evidence of that in previous matches. There was zero evidence of that against Djokovic. And a lot of that is Djokovic's serving. He was hitting his spots, hitting the corners.
He has been serving brilliantly all week, should be said, and you can see the delight on Goran Ivanišević's face. Without doubt, he's had an influence on that. He is serving brilliantly. But even Djokovic at his best serving, you should be making returns. Mm. This is not Ivo Karlovic. Shapovalov should have been making more returns.
And he had a very, very small moment in the second set where he got a break point after he was already down a break.
Yeah, this is what counted as a moment, folks.
This was a moment, a break point, and he missed two returns in a row and then made an unforced error and lost 3 points in a row, and that was the game.
And that was the match, to be honest. That moment
inevitable.
Was a little bit of a slight lapse from Djokovic more than inspiration.
It was a microcosm of their first ever meeting. This was their fourth, all of them been won by Djokovic. Their first ever meeting, which was earlier this year, the Australian Open, when you watched that match courtside, didn't you, Matt?
I took my seat with a whole lot of excitement, and it evaporated after about three games when
was it hot that day?
Yes, but the media seats were nicely in the shade.
Okay.
And I remember thinking that Djokovic was a tennis player who was balanced, and Shapovalov was a tennis player who was flailing about all over the place and literally hitting shots and falling backwards. That's my overarching memory of that match, the way Djokovic was able to create as much power just by kind of getting his momentum going forward and kind of blocking the ball and being stable. And Shapovalov was kind of all arms and legs and not really creating much more power than Djokovic or doing anything more effective. And Djokovic swatted him aside. Shapovalov got a set, got a moment, almost as though he was kind of happy with that. And then Djokovic ran through the fourth set, 6-love. And you asked me earlier this week whether I thought Shapovalov had made major strides. And the reason now I think it's only strides is because he's not hurting the top players in the same way that a Tsitsipas or a Medvedev are hurting Djokovic. Okay, not this week because Tsitsipas kind of got blown off the court, but he has done this year. Shapovalov still looks quite a way away from.
Yeah, if you watch today's match with Djokovic and the Australian Open match, I think you would struggle to see progress. And I'm not saying he hasn't made progress, because we have seen evidence of it in other matches this week. Obviously, the breakthrough in Stockholm, but today there was no evidence of it, and failing to produce on the biggest stage against the top players, you know, it's a compliment to him that we're talking about him in these terms. He expects that of himself. It'd be worse if we were saying, oh, well, he's not beating Djokovic, but no one's expecting him to challenge Djokovic, because then you're putting him in a different bracket. I think we're holding him to account because of what we want and expect from him. And he's not, well, he didn't deliver today. And you said about Barty earlier in our pre-podcast podcast that she doesn't play shots, she plays points, which is the inverse of Denis Shapovalov. And today he played the wrong shots, and I was looking at him thinking, stop thinking, Denis, stop having thoughts. Who was it that said the thing, and I think this is the wrong way to express it, but there was a legendary tennis player, I'm going to say maybe McEnroe or Connors, that said, to be a top player, and he was probably trying to give himself a compliment in the process of saying this, to be a top tennis player, you either have to be really smart or really dumb. Who was it that said that?
I don't know, but it's a great line.
I tried to Google it earlier, and Google's denied all knowledge of it. I obviously haven't put the right words in.
I think it was probably said in the pub.
I'm pretty sure it was either McEnroe or Connors. And I don't think that's the right way of expressing it in terms of intelligence and lack thereof. But I think there's a grain of something in there about thinking. There are players that I feel confident in having thoughts on a tennis court. For example, take the big four. I would put Rafael Nadal in the not having so many thoughts on a tennis court category. It's very, very... Rafael Nadal sees tennis very, very simply. He knows what he's doing out there, sees tennis ball, hits tennis ball. He knows how to use his game to the maximum, stay in the moment, compete as hard as he can.
He doesn't allow himself to have outside thoughts.
No, exactly. It's not necessary. It's not helpful. It's very, very simple. Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, they're problem solvers. They're astute tacticians. They're having thoughts out there. They're problem solving. And I trust them to have thoughts. I'm fine with them having thoughts. I want Denis Shapovalov to have fewer thoughts.
Do you want him to go on pre-programmed by Mikhail Yuzhny?
Yeah, I do. I want Mikhail Yuzhny to drill something into him that's in his muscle memory.
Brainwash
so that he
him.
Can go out there on the court with it just in his veins and just do some kind of hypnosis so he can just be like Nadal and be in the moment, which I know is easier said than done. I get that. Download, you know, Headspace, whatever. just stop having thoughts. Because they don't work. You're making the wrong decision.
Also,
and I would say, I'd probably say the same for Zverev. You know, I was thinking about the next gen, and I was thinking, oh, if I sort of inadvertently struck upon something here, I want Zverev to have fewer thoughts. Medvedev, I trust to have thoughts.
Right.
Yeah, he figures things out. He finds your weakness and he hones in on it.
Yeah. And he identifies what he's not doing wrong, what he's doing wrong, and eliminates it, and that's fine. It's just, I don't like the way you're looking at me. It sounded really good.
Well,
when Matt and I were discussing it earlier before you got here.
Am I trusted to have thoughts or not? Look at the look on her face.
You have thoughts at 3 o'clock in the morning, don't you?
I had a couple of corkers last night. Anyway, you'll be hearing about those on the Tennis Podcast in a few weeks.
It feels like sometimes, as you said, Catherine, we're being kind of harsh on Shapovalov, or kind of we want more from him, but because we know it's there. Like, I think I put out on Twitter that the most exciting thing, from my perspective, to happen to the next gen would be Shapovalov realizing his potential.
Why?
Because as much as I like the way a lot of the others play, especially Tsitsipas, I love the all-court nature of his tennis, it doesn't make me gasp in the way that Shapovalov does. When he's on, like he was against Monfils.
Was he on balance against Monfils?
Yes, he was. He wasn't falling backwards, hitting shots. He'd made that progress at that level.
He
but he hasn't made the progress at the level up, which Tsitsipas kind of has made.
He has the potential to play the tennis that Dominic Thiem played against Diego Schwartzman in the Vienna final, which literally made me gasp.
Yeah.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Novak Djokovic, we talk about Ash Barty being a point player. I feel like Djokovic has become the arch point player in recent years. He has worked out patterns, and he's also become incredibly good at winning points with... Remember when he beat Zverev by dropping the ball short repeatedly, I think in Rome, somewhere like that. Because whenever I see Zverev against Djokovic, I sometimes think, oh, you know, Zverev can probably go toe-to-toe with him, you know, big shots, great backhand, big serve. So what does Djokovic do? Doesn't give him any of that. Starts dropping it short.
And I think that part of his game is really underrated. It's easy to think of Djokovic as a bit of a ball machine, but he's not. He does create angles.
But he used to be that.
He used to be that.
He has, like, properly developed his game. He's not just a returner who puts it on the baseline and drills. It's not as artistic to look at as it is with other players.
No, it doesn't make you gasp.
But
it is...
In its efficiency, it makes you your mind boggle in its own right, in that way.
He's having thoughts, and they're good thoughts.
Yeah, they work, those
and
thoughts.
I feel like the two keys for Djokovic now, probably for the rest of his career really, are number one, his fitness. We've seen he's had little niggles this year with his shoulder and his elbow and not quite allowed him to play the tennis he wants. And number two, his focus. And I think he's pretty much always going to be focused at the slams now. We're just going to, because he's in the Grand Slam race, he's going to be focused. But I really think that having the year in number one to go for has kind of sharpened his mind. He's a different player to what we saw in Shanghai, even Tokyo, which he kind of cruised through.
What's the point differential now for the end of the year?
640.
And there's 1,500 available to the winner of the O2. So
yeah, and Nadal is a big question mark. So I think he's going to do it.
If they played each other in the final, Nadal is the champion, right?
He's
the number one.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But if
As long as Nadal goes through the group undefeated, maybe? I'm not sure.
But if Nadal doesn't reach the the final and Djokovic wins it, I think that that would give it to Djokovic.
Yes,
wouldn't
it? That's right.
Yeah. I think Djokovic is going to do it.
Wow.
And I just, there's just a different vibe about him. It feels like he's playing a similar sort of tennis. Maybe not quite at the level that he played at the Australian Open, but certainly.
I don't think it's far off.
It's not far off.
I really
he's
don't.
He's really playing well.
I also think being sick this week has focused his mind. He's known there's no room for expending any extraneous energy, because even in even in tournaments that he's been brilliant at this year, you've still seen the odd match where he's looked irritable, or the odd set where he's looked really irritable, and you've thought he just hasn't looked like that sort of impenetrable winning machine for a period. There, apart from in the first round against Corentin Moutet, where I think he really was ill. Since then, it's been right. Just I can't afford to expend any energy that's not required here, and it's been so businesslike.
And I think I'm right in saying that he hasn't lost a tiebreak since Wimbledon, when he lost. I think it was Hubert Hurkacz got him in a tiebreak in like second or third round, and since then he's won every single tiebreak, starting with those 3-1 against Federer in the final of Wimbledon. And as you said, Catherine, that's got to make you feel invincible in tiebreaks, winning those three without hitting an unforced error. You're just going to think, this is my turf.
Do you know this Grand Slam race? What's he on, 16? Nadal, 19, Federer, 20. It kind of passed me by in a way in the last few weeks that Nadal is that close. And I heard in your studio, Greg Rozinski saying, Nadal's going to reach 20 next year. You know, just
casually putting it out.
Casually, but then you think, well, probably, because he'll probably win the French Open. I mean, where's it going to end up?
How have we come back to this again?
Isn't it fascinating? Anyway.
Can I divert your attention from the greatest of all time debate?
Yes, go ahead.
Can we mention the doubles?
Yeah, I was getting onto that. Go on.
It was Totsimoche.
Totsimoche. What? Hold on. What does that mean? What's that mean? Totsimoche. For my mum. She won't know what that
Hugues-Hébert.
Means.
It was totally emotional.
Oh, okay,
Pierre Hugues-Hébert and Nicolas Mahut won over Karen Khachanov and Andrei Rublev. Their first Paris Masters title. Their seventh Masters overall. And it was just lovely.
I thought they broke up.
They did, but...
didn't Andy Murray get in the way?
In a line that I'm recycling from the Prime coverage that it was not received well by Greg Rozinski, he looked at me like I'd lost my marbles. If you love someone, set them free. That is what Nicolas Mahut did to Pierre Hugues-Hébert.
Have you got a video of Greg's face? I want to see that.
But
perplexed.
But the thing is, Mahut wasn't happy about it.
Yeah, but it... But that's love, isn't it?
Yeah.
It hurt him, but he knew that he had to.
So let me get this right.
It's all come full circle.
Yeah. A bear had given up doubles and walked out on Mahut.
Oh well, no, well, that's the.
No, he had decided to focus on singles, and that meant
out on Mahut.
Walking out on Mahut.
Right, he'd given up doubles effectively, and then Andy Murray walks up and says, "Well, I wouldn't mind playing doubles with you," and he said, "Absolutely fine.
I'm having a bit of that." Yeah,
and then that didn't
and there
work
were all those
very well.
Really emotional. Quotes about it where
and the funny thing is Mahut then got to the Wimbledon final with Roger Vassalan.
So what's happened to Roger Vassalan?
He was only a
where's he?
He was a stand.
He was the rebound guy.
Yeah,
I understand that, but where
have
is
you
he?
Never watched like Dawson's Creek or anything, David?
Is he over there in that
this
corner?
This is a well-worn narrative.
So I want to know what's happened to Roger Vassalan. Talk amongst
He's fine.
Yourselves.
He was a MacGuffin, wasn't he? He was a plot device in the ultimate love story of Pierre Hugues-Hébert and Nicolas Mahut. And before you think that I'm just creating something where it doesn't exist here, during the speeches
this
today...
This was amazing.
Pierre Hugues-Hébert was giving his lovely, heartfelt trophy acceptance speech paying tribute to everyone and his dad, you know, saying I hadn't won a match in 3 months and my team stuck with me, and Nicolas Mahut dropped to his knees and it looked for a moment like he was going to propose. Yeah, it was. Well,
and it's like their love is stronger for each other given all that they've been through this year.
Yeah.
And it was like Hébert was taking responsibility for it. I learned a new French word, just be fautif. He said, I'm at fault for this, for what happened to us this year. And this was kind of like my redemption in a way, you know, just making it all right again. Because Bess is such a big deal for the French players.
Yeah.
And Mahut was talking about how he used to sit in the stands. And
oh, that was really emotional. Mahut in his speech said, because obviously Guy Forget was standing there, tournament director. How's he got so many jobs? He's tournament director of Bercy and the French Open.
Because he is cool.
They
did show a video of him from 91, and you said, when he won the title, I think it was 91, you said, how come he looks younger now than he did then? And he does.
He really does.
28 years ago.
Nicolas Mahut said that he was in the stands with his dad watching Guy Forget beat Goran Ivanišević here. I can't remember the year that he said, but anyway, he remembers, you know, as a little kid, that was one of his first tennis watching memories, and he said, I hope there are some young kids in the stands just now that have watched this today and are similarly inspired. And oh, it was,
and his own son was on court.
Oh, Nathaniel, who is adorable. It had everything. It was an epic. It was Shakespearean.
I mean, this is magnificent, right? I'm still a bit worried about Roger Vasselin, right? Who has gone from Wimbledon with Mahut, having lost in five just heartbreaking sets. And from there, he's gone on and he's played in Washington with Mahut. He's played in Canada with him. He's played in Cincinnati with Austin Krajicek. And then, listen to all these
partners. That's a come down, isn't it?
All these partners he's had. He managed to get a little bit of a run out with Mahut in Moselle, and they got to the final there. And he got to the final in Japan, the Japan Open, and he won that with Mahut. So that was all lovely.
Oh.
But then since then, he's been ditched. Because he goes to Stockholm, and he's playing with Henri Kontinen.
Henri Kontinen's a top-notch doubles player.
But Pierre Hugerbert turns up, and then suddenly Roger Vasselin's out, and now he's playing with Gasquet in the Swiss indoors, and he only gets to the round of 16.
It sounds like he's sowing his wild oats. It's fine.
And then he turns up to Paris, and he plays with Jürgen Meltzer. So he's playing with everybody and his dog now.
Who knew Jürgen Meltzer wasn't retired?
round of 16. So, you know, you shouldn't be feeling sorry for Mahut. You should be feeling sorry for Roger Vasselin. Because he's the one who, the chain reaction is the one, he's got hurt.
No one feels sorry for the rebound guy.
No.
If you never watched a...
He was lucky to get in the first place.
Yeah.
Talking of plot devices, I was watching Succession last night, and Catherine said to me, there is no Basil exposition. Do you know what that means?
No.
So neither did I. So characters. Catherine sent it to me. She sent me the Wikipedia definition. So this is even more niche than the Urban Dictionary.
I think it's a Kermode and Mayo specific, like Wikipedia.
A Basil exposition is a character from the Austin Powers movies whose main role is to act as a device to provide the audience with the background to the film's plot.
It means when one of the characters explains a load of plot backstory as if it's normal conversation.
And she says, when such a character appears in a film unironically, it is often a sign of clumsy writing.
Yeah.
So this was Catherine bigging up Succession because there were none of those, which is problematic for somebody like me who could kind of do with one just to understand what's going on. But anyway, I was concentrating very, very closely and occasionally checking with Catherine what's happening.
Have you made it through a full episode yet without falling asleep?
No. But, you know,
you have a train journey soon.
A bit like with DVDs, you can rewind. So it's quite good. So there's my my recommendation. The people playing Monopoly have gone. The Bricklayers Arms is advertising for cricketers at the moment, if anybody's interested.
And singers.
Sunday,
for shanties.
Sunday and midweek social cricket side friendly matches only. Anyone wanting to play, please contact Chris Locke.
I feel like we might need to alert them that that's an out-of-date sign. Season runs until September the 29th.
Oh, dear.
That's been and gone.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, tennis podcast listeners, you can't play cricket after all. So that brings, I think, another one of our episodes to a close. We have the Fed Cup coming up, folks.
It's going more to be Ash Barty.
Australia.
Excellent.
Against France. The teams are already there. I've seen Caroline Garcia in business class showing off. It's good, it's good, isn't it, being a tennis player?
I really have an issue with any social media postings that reveal that you're in anything other than economy class anywhere.
Quite right. So anyway, that's going to happen, and it all starts on Friday. We're going to have a daily... No, it starts on Saturday. Saturday and Sunday, but our first podcast will be from preview day, which is Friday. More podcasts than you can throw a Friday at. Oh, no. Yeah? Catherine's looking chastened.
Given that we've brought up Bruce Springsteen, I went to see his excellent film earlier this week, in which he said to keep
was
your...
Was it excellent?
Oh, it was really good, yeah. To keep...
Look at his little face, he's chuffed.
Tennis and Bruce Springsteen, how have I managed this? To keep your audience engaged, you need to do two things. You need to make them feel at home, and you need to surprise them. So I feel like by doing dailies from all these other events, we are keeping them, making them feel at home with dailies, but surprising them by doing new events. So it's a tenuous Bruce Springsteen link, but I think it works.
I think is Matt allowed to think?
I'm not.
It sounds like he is.
Yeah, Matt is the Daniil Medvedev, right, of the tennis podcast.
Okay, right.
Hang on, no, I'm the Daniil Medvedev of the tennis podcast.
Okay.
You're the Tsitsipas?
I'll take that.
Yeah.
Who's David?
Monica Niculescu.
I'll take that. And with that, we will come back to you with Fed Cup news when the draw has been made, when we've hopefully got to hear from some of the players, when Ash Barty's got over her jet lag, and we're ready to go with the Fed Cup final, which I think is going to be an absolute belter. Two great nations packed with players. I mean, Kiki Mladenovic is going to be playing doubles as well. There's so much to look forward to there. ATP finals as well next week. We're going to be daily from that. Matt's going to be on site with us. We've got the Davis Cup finals as well.
I don't know how we're going to surprise people next year, because there's literally no more podcasting available.
I've run out of extension ideas. For this year.
We're going to surprise people next year by doing fewer podcasts.
But don't let that stop you from crowdfunding us on the 2nd of December if you would like to back us so that we can produce what is looking like getting up to 130 podcasts for the year this year. If you'd like to see something
like it.
If you'd like to...
Bruce would be proud.
Hear similar next year, then you can back us in our Kickstarter when we launch it on the 2nd of December. If you want a reminder, if this wasn't a good enough reminder for you, scroll down in your notes on your phone and click Support the Tennis Podcast, and we'll send you one reminder on the 2nd of December when we launch. We have been executive produced by tennispause.com, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by our lovely Rio with a Y, and we will be back a Fed Cup final preview in a few days' time, and we can't wait.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too.
Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.